Golf Smarter number 666.
Golf Smarter number 666 is brought to you by TGW, the sweetest spot in golf. Wow, we're only a few weeks into our campaign for TGW, and I want to thank you for checking out the great selection and fabulous savings on everything golf they have to offer. The early reports that you're visiting the site are encouraging, but not everyone has started shopping. So let's put an end to that with two more announcements for TGW. First, you're still welcome and encouraged to go directly to our customized Golf Smarter landing page through our links in the show notes or by clicking on their ad at golfsmarter.com. But if it's easier, then go ahead directly to tgw.com because we've set up a coupon code for you to use at checkout. Use Golf Smarter, that's one word, Golf Smarter at checkout for the special offer. And now our second announcement is that special offer. With that coupon code, you'll get an extra 20% off of apparel. Of course, some exclusions apply, nor can this discount be combined with other discount offers. Due to manufacturer policies, some other items may be excluded, and then the exclusions are all Titleist, FootJoy, Under Armour items, and select Nike items. To see all the apparel that qualify for our 20% off sale, go to tgw.com/golfsmarter. You'll also see the instruction to enter the coupon code GOLFSMARTER at checkout. The exclusive Golf Smarter 20% off apparel sale ends February 5th, 2019 at 11:59 p.m. Central Time. Again, I'd really like to thank TGW for their support of Golf Smarter, and I'd like to thank you for your support as well. Smarter golfers play better when they think like a golf course architect with golf course architect Trip Davis.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing stories, tips, and insights from great golf minds to help you lower your score and raise your golf IQ. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Trip.
Hey, Fred, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm so glad to have you back on the show. It's amazing to me that the first time we spoke, that was like episode 14 in early 2006, and here we are in the high 600 of episodes, and this is your fifth appearance on the podcast. So thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me again.
You bet. I didn't realize I'd been on that many times, but I do remember the first time. I was actually in Pittsburgh, I think, when we did it.
Wow.
And don't remember the other four. I think one of them, I think I was in L.A., because I remember I was actually out there to play in the George Thomas mid-am at LACC.
Wow.
I think, but that's pretty good for me to remember those two, actually.
Well, actually, what happened was you were on 14, 162, and then I think we recorded a long one and cut it into two on episodes 323 and 324. That's probably why. So if anybody wants to go back now, if anyone's going to go back and listen to those, and I encourage you to do it because you're going to learn a ton, that those are going to be available at smarter.golf, not on iTunes, not on Stitcher, none of those, because they only carry like the last 250 or so episodes. And these are way before that, but the entire archives are at smarter.golf. You can find that there. Okay. Now let's get to Trip Davis here. Trip, I'm not trying to put you on the spot to be the spokesperson for all of golf architects in the world, but if you don't mind me asking, how's the state of your industry right now?
Well, I think it varies by region a decent amount. I think it varies by part of the world you're in to some extent. I think it also depends on what your background is, what kind of things you emphasize, maybe specialize in. And since I started my own firm 25 years ago here in a couple months, actually.
Congratulations.
Yeah, that's not bad.
It's not bad at all.
I've done mostly renovations, and then in 1999, I really started doing a lot of historic restoration. And that part of the golf architecture market and construction market has really always been pretty solid, even through the 08-09 downturn. I even remember back after 9/11 when a lot of projects took a hit or got put on hold or whatever it may have been. Yeah. The renovation restoration market has stayed pretty steady, and we've been fortunate because we've been able to kind of build off of some of the things we've done and just develop our reputation and be able to, you know, keep really about as busy as we've wanted to. So we're lucky in that regard, but you know, the new course market obviously is almost non-existent. I mean, there are
in the United States or worldwide?
Worldwide, really. I mean, China was a big area for a while, and I actually did a course over there in 2012, 2013. China is really dead. I don't know if there's more than two or three projects ongoing there right now.
Wow.
And, oddly enough, I think probably the place in the world that has more golf course projects under construction right now is Vietnam.
Really?
And, there's, I know of about 10 that I, rough count, but I don't know of 10 in the United States. And, it's made it more difficult for a lot of golf course architects. Some of them have had to, downsize and or, diversify a bit. You know, some have kind of gone back to the roots of doing landscape architecture in addition to golf architecture work that they can pick up. But I wouldn't say that. I think it's okay right now. And I personally think that it's going to slow down. The amount of renovation restoration work that's out there, a lot of it has been done, and I would say that, you know, we're going to probably see a bit of a slowdown in terms of larger renovation and restoration projects. While, doing the small stuff where we're, you know, doing a driving range tee or we're renovating tees, some of those things are cyclical because about every 7 to 10 years, you've got to redo tees, you know, about every 10 to 15 years, you got to redo bunkers. And so some of that is cyclical, but the complete, you know, renovation, restoration projects, I think are going to start to slow down some.
Hmm. Why do you think that the interest is so high in Vietnam and there's so many projects going on where there's none in the rest of the world?
Well, some of it has to do with tourism over there. I do know that read a little bit about Vietnam's tourism industry is on an upswing, and plus you've got, you know, there's apparently a lot of really good sites over there. I've not been to Vietnam and seen. When I was doing my project in China, I kind of explored the Asian market a little bit and went and looked in Malaysia and Indonesia, even in Singapore, but never made it to Vietnam to look at anything. But the guys that I know that are doing work there, most of them have more than one project. And, Brian Curley, I think, is doing a multi-course project. So I think it is tourism driven. I think it's the sites over there, from what I understand, are amazing. And so I think there's the golf industry is pushing it, and then tourism in Vietnam is pushing it. And I think the economy, for Eastern Asia is doing okay, and that's where they're trying to draw a lot of people. That tourism's not going to be for Vietnamese. It's going to be for Chinese, Japanese, mm-hmm. Koreans, Malaysians, Indonesians, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. How much? It's so interesting because when we first got together and talked about this stuff, the Tiger effect was in full effect. He was at the peak of his game, and golf courses were being built. They couldn't build them fast enough because so many people were wanting to play golf. And then he went through his tumultuous life and dragged the rest of the golf world down with it, it feels like. And ever since then, people are like, how are we going to get people back to golf? How are we going to get people back to golf? And less courses were being developed and less money was being spent on new courses. And now there's this resurgence of interest in him. Do you see any correlation going on there as well?
No, I don't. I think the issues he had personally, mm-hmm. I think just were a perfect storm coinciding with our market here. Because I think his problems were in 2009, if I remember right. And, that was when the housing market really became, new development became almost non-existent. And so a lot of the housing development that was being spurred on by or a lot of the golf course development was being spurred on by housing development in the early 2000s. And so I think his downturn just kind of happened to coincide with, a downturn in the golf and the economy to the point where that was a factor. And I think we're also seeing that, almost 10 years on, your 35-year-olds, they still play golf. They still try to be involved in golf, but there's just not as much time. I mean, the demographics have changed. They work harder and in a good way, I think they're more family oriented. But the key is really getting kids into golf and having that be a pull effect to moms and dads. And
right.
That's why I think we're seeing a lot of these short courses, which we've actually done three in the last year and a half, 2 years. So I think that's if there is an uptick in the golf business, it is on these alternative shorter courses because that's where kids can be more comfortable. Parents have – it takes less time. And so we're seeing more of that.
It's interesting. When I was working around Major League Baseball, they used to talk about all we have to do is get the 5-year-olds hooked. And once we got them, we got them for life. And we can drag the family along with it. And it sounds like that's similar going on here. What do you mean by short courses and these type of courses that are being built?
Well, I think, there's some variations there, but the ones that we've done recently have been, 30 years ago, we'd have called them pitch and putts. And the one I did one in Tyler, Texas at a really neat club there on a really cool piece of property, actually. And it's a 4-hole course. And so there's 4 greens in this instance. And in most instances with these shorter courses today, there aren't any of your formal tee boxes. You can kind of tee it up anywhere and play it anywhere. And so that's one version of it. And that's what we've done a decent amount of. And then you've also got these shorter courses where it's it might be 6 regulation length holes. It might be 4 regulation length holes. We did a project in Ocala, Florida, that opened in 2016 that is a combination of par 3 holes. And then there's also within that, there's a 6-hole loop of regulation length holes that you can play 3 times. It's a par 70 that's about 6,600 yards long. And it's in a active adult community that Shea Holmes, their trilogy division, did. And it's a so the golf course is, it just takes less time to play. And it's proven to be a good fit for a senior housing development, which I think, from what I understand, I've been down there a couple times since it's open, but, they're getting a lot of grandkids that like to play it. So that's what I mean by short courses. That can either be the old pitch and putts or, fewer holes, not necessarily shorter holes.
It's interesting. It's either for the kids or the grandparents because the parents are too busy to play. So let's hook the rest of them. Does this mean that there's no par fives or no par fours in par fives? Or,
well, on the shorter, on the little more like pitch and putt projects that we've done recently, it's really just par threes. And the one we did in Tyler, the holes vary from, you can really play it as short as you want. To the longest hole we've got there you can play is about 150. We did one another one that again you can play it as short as you want, and it's the longest hole is about 130. But at Ocala there is one par 5 in that six-hole loop. And so if you play it three times, you're also then playing a par three three times, and the other holes are par fours. And so that's where you get the par from. But the par five we did, there's actually, you know, you can play it as long as 540. And Tom Lehman and I did it together, and it's a fun little golf course. I mean, it's for me, you know, I'm not in that 35 year old crowd, but I still, as hard as I work these days, and you know, when I get out to play, the club here in Norman, I play at it. There's a little 4-hole loop that I can go play, and that's pretty much what I do.
I love this. I love the idea of no tee markers, that you can just tee it up wherever you're comfortable. Is that kind of playing off of the play it forward concept? Just not intimidate little people with, like, you have to hit it from here.
Yeah, well, that, I think, you know, there's something to that, but it also has to do with the ability to have more variety, because if you, you know, the knock on par three courses has always been, well, you know, the holes are the same length every time you go around. And one of the advantages of, especially when you've only got like four holes, if you can play it from anywhere, then it can be a different hole every time you play it. So that's one aspect. And then the other is that if you, most of these holes are going to be where you're going to take a divot. And so, you know, if we had just your formal tee boxes, the tee boxes couldn't be large enough to just get beaten up. And so having it all as fairway and encouraging players to move around, not having markers out there, it does help spread the wear around. And so that's the other element, is the fact that it's more maintainable without having the formal tee boxes.
With all the demands on our time we've just talked about, and families and, you know, the 30-somethings who are, like, too busy with their work and whatnot, has there ever been a consideration or even a request for a course that is, instead of a front nine, back nine, that you have three sixes, that someone can go out and play six holes, they can play 12 holes, they can play 18?
Well, I think that's, you know, that's been something that operators have acknowledged for a long time. I remember when we did a golf course in Colorado where, you know, the operator wanted us to try to get the golf course back to the clubhouse after six holes if we could, or get it somewhere near the clubhouse, both on the front nine and the back nine. And that was part of the emphasis. This was a housing development for, you know, it was a resort housing development, but, you know, we've been seeing time demand issues in the game and the way that we design new courses for almost as long as I've been in the business. You know, I've been doing this for 28 years now, and 25 on my own. And ever since then, there's been a looming, time demand issue, to the point where, you know, now it's a very strong issue. I mean, the USGA is actually, you know, as you well know, is, you know, allow you to turn in a 9-hole score for a handicap, and and so that is part of that reaction as well. So it's you know, how you route the golf course to be able to give, you know, the players options, I think is something that's been around for a while. But yeah, We haven't, you know, the last new course we did was, other than the Ocala project, was it was in China, actually. And we didn't have that option there because of the way the land worked. But we're always looking at that, because I think it's something that, you know, adds variety into the way the facility can be used.
Cool. And let me take a quick time out to talk about Peter Millar. Is fall your favorite time of year to play golf? Personally, I'm not a huge fan of playing in the cold. That's because I'm a California born and bred weather wimp. But lucky for me, when the air gets crisp and the leaves are turning, and yes, they do turn here in California too, not all of them, but some of them do, I can stay warm and look great in a Perth pullover from Peter Millar. I gotta tell you, it instantly cuts the cold. It's amazing how well it works. It's kind of like being wrapped in a warm towel. Speaking of such, here's a free idea for your significant other this holiday. when she or he gets in the shower, grab her towel and put it in the dryer for a couple minutes, and then return and wrap her in a warm towel. It works. Promise. Now back to Peter Millar. So while the other guys in my foursome are rubbing their hands and shaking from the cold after a few hours, and that's because I choose to play with California weather wimps, I couldn't be more comfortable or happier because their cold is also showing up in their play. So you stay cold. I'll be warm. I'll play better. And not only is the Perth perfect to wear out on the course, it feels great and it looks even better. It fits like a second skin and it moves so you don't even notice when you're wearing it on the course. So when you're swinging, it's not going to restrict you in any way. Trust me, you'll win style points around the office when you pair it with jeans or business casual days. The Perth looks great over a polo shirt or a sport shirt. So do yourself a favor. Get yourself a Perth pullover today. Your game and you will thank me. Right now, head over to petermillar.com/golfsmarter to get yours. And while you're there, check out some of my other Peter Millar favorites that I picked out for you to see. Be sure to use my link and you'll receive complimentary shipping and a free hat. That's Peter Millar, M-I-L-L-A-R, petermillar.com/golfsmarter. petermillar.com/golfsmarter. Trip, I noticed on your website a press release that just came out yesterday that you guys signed a deal to do a renovation, I guess it is, for the Oklahoma City Golf and Country Club, which is right in your backyard. I can imagine if you didn't get the gig, you'd be pretty pissed off.
Well, yeah, it was... It's actually come around a couple of times. About 10 years ago, they were looking for someone to do a master plan, and I didn't get it. And I was told the reason I didn't get it, you know, and you, I try my best when we don't get something to, you know, just move on. I, you know, you, there's no value in getting upset or burning any bridges, but, you know, a friend of mine that was a club member at the time said I was too close, and you know, and they wanted to get someone from outside the area, and it came back around about a year and a half ago, and with a little bit of a change in the leadership of the club, they were more serious about, instead of just planning for a renovation and restoration, they wanted to go through with it. And good thing is, over the last 10 years, my reputation for doing that historical restoration work has gotten better, and so I did get it. And being in my backyard is great because the last 10 years, pretty much, you know, I haven't worked a great deal at home, especially on a big complete project like this, and so I was able to. With some of my other clients, you know, somewhat pushed some other work off. And so between February and September of next year, this will be the only project I have under construction. And being 30 minutes from my house and being able to sleep in my own bed, I might actually have some semblance of a life next year.
Well, congratulations on that. It looks like a really special course. And any time you get to work for on an Alistair McKenzie design, that's got to be a lot of fun.
It is. I mean, one of the really cool things about this golf course is the greens have 15 of the greens have barely been touched. They were regrassed. They changed the profile about 4 years ago, but they did a really good job of pretty much just putting it back the way it was. And there's been three greens that have changed a little bit. You know, the club's direction to us and you know, what I saw anyway is that these greens need to be preserved rather than, you know, changed much, if any. And that, to me, when you've got a really well-routed golf course, which this one is, Alistair McKenzie and Perry Maxwell worked on it together. And I think Perry Maxwell was probably the best among any architects in the history of the game at routing golf courses. And so, with the routing that they did, and then, you know, definitely with these McKenzie-inspired type of greens, It's a very fun old style, you know, classic golf course. And so the emphasis for us is really to try to put some things back that have changed a bit. Not so much modernize it as just tweak things enough to where the modern player can appreciate what their original intent was. And some of that is fairway bunkers, making sure that instead of being 240 from a back tee, you know, they get moved out to where they're really more in play, or, you know, we don't really have a lot of room to push tees back, and I just don't think it would fit here anyway. But that's the emphasis, is really trying to restore the look, feel, and design intent, and, you know, and do it in such a way that the modern player can appreciate it and can enjoy it.
Is that what the difference is between a restoration and a renovation, is having more consideration about who's playing it today?
Well, you know, it just really kind of depends on how you want to define any of those things. I mean, you know, renovation is more about just, you know, replacing the infrastructure. You're not really changing a great deal. Restoration to me is more about recapturing, restoring design intent, preserving some things like the greens there, rather than changing them. And to me, restoration should be about doing it in such a way that the modern player can appreciate it and enjoy it. You know, obviously, if you were going to do a pure restoration of an old house, for instance, and you know, you would put things back exactly the way they were. You know, there's even, if you go to the extent of doing really historic restoration, you forego some of the things, some of the modern things like lighting and so forth. But with a golf course, it's meant to be played, and it's going to be played by the modern player with modern equipment and, you know, a modern approach to the way that the game is played. And it just does no good to restore the golf course in a more pure sense, because they're not going to appreciate it or really enjoy it to the extent they could if they were, if you give them the ability to experience the design intent or the philosophy and the way that the golf course was meant to be played. Now, obviously, a lot of guys will say, well, then you've got to make the golf course 7,700 yards long for them to be able to play it the same way that it was meant to be played back then. And I don't agree with that in large measure, because I think, you know, the game's evolved to some extent. And, you know, these older golf courses like this, also, in my opinion, especially one like Oklahoma City, you know, Colonial is a great example of a similar type of golf course where the design of the golf course through the routing and the positioning of features and the way the greens are built doesn't really allow a long player to dominate, you know, to use that strength to a greater advantage than a shorter player can use precision and you know, in short game. And so it's fun for me, and that's kind of falls into my philosophy, because I know there's a lot of golf course architects today that in doing renovations or rebuilds or reconstructing old golf courses, they're making them extremely long because they think that's the way the modern player just hits it that long. And I don't see it that way, because if you look at the average length of the tour player today, it's right at 289 yards. That's the average length guy. And, you know, you would have a lot of people that would think that everybody on the PGA Tour hits it over 300 yards, and they just don't. And I think golf courses like Oklahoma City and you know, Colonials, like, you know, is a good example. Oak Hills down in San Antonio that we redid last year, an old Tillinghast there, they have more balance that they're allowing players of different abilities to compete on the basis of score rather than just having one domineering facet to their game.
And so when you're talking about the modern player and 7,700 yards, is that because they want you to create a course that could possibly be on the tour, or is it country club golf and they just want to make it so it continues to be hard? Because even if it's not 7,700 yards, it's still hard.
Mm-hmm.
The game is still difficult. No matter what the equipment is, the game doesn't get easier, does it?
Well, and that's one of the things that I see with, you know, lengthening of golf courses too, is, you know, proverbially they've also pulled other tees back. And, you know, when I was growing up, and I'm sure you remember the same, I mean, you know, the middle tees at the golf course I grew up was a par 72, and the middle tees were like 6,400 yards long. And, you know, that would be considered short for a middle tee by today's standards in a lot of places. By taking the approach of, you know, challenging better players through strategy and having to, you know, show different types of games and through giving them choices, you're also making it such that the average player has choices and they're not beat over the head the same way. Because the game, you've made a good point, the game's hard enough. So design needs to allow the average player physically to be able to have choices and to be able to make choices that allow them to play the game in a way that fits their game. And you know, one of the real keys to that as well is to give the golf course the flexibility so that the setup, whether it's tee box, you know, is tee locations, hole locations, and really a great deal today is green speed, is getting it to where the average player can enjoy it 51 weeks out of the year. And then 1 week you might have a state am, or you might have a senior open or a PGA Tour event. So that's kind of the way I see it. But we've got one golf course that we're working with that, you know, wants to have another major event at Oak Tree up north of Oklahoma City. But the rest of the ones we're working with, you know, the emphasis is on making sure that 99% of the membership enjoys it, you know, every week, every day of the year.
I kind of want to change directions a little bit. I find this so fascinating. But what I'm really curious is, when you're saying challenging through strategy, you're challenging the player in your design. Let's talk about that for the things that you put into a golf course, that you see in a golf course that are to mess with the golfer's head, is how I see it. It's like, right? You know, it's the water or the bunker right in front of the pin type of thing.
Well, a lot of it goes to the visual effect of the game. You can do a lot with very subtle visual elements to make the golf course a little bit more difficult to read. And you can do a lot with angles. And that's one of the things I think is a lost art in a lot of modern design work, is understanding how angles really can still impact the game. Even the average player today hits it, you know, doesn't curve the ball as much if they're hitting it solid. But it really goes to giving them choices to make. And it's not so much about, well, you know, to get to this pin, you need to be on the left side of the fairway. Sometimes it needs to be more about, well, I can play this hole more conservatively by taking less than driver off the tee to take some bunkers at the corner out of play. And I'm coming in with a little bit longer club, but I've taken one element of risk out of play. And so the more options you give players, the more decisions you give them to have to make, the more interesting it is. And oddly enough, for better players, that does as much to challenge them as tall rough or, you know, really severe greens or really penal features, because the better players really want to be able to stand up on the tee, see the shot immediately, and swing. And the more choices you give them, the more decisions you give them to make, the more challenging it's going to be.
Do you have a signature design that let's see, how do I word this so it makes sense? Someone will look at it, this design element, that's the word I was looking for, a design element, and go, oh, that's a Trip Davis move, you know, because there are courses where you go, oh, that's a Greg Norman, oh, that's an Alistair McKenzie, right? There are those elements that are put into the design. Are there some that are your signature elements?
I don't know if they'd
be
my
favorite.
Well, I've seen, they're my favorites as much as anything, because I've seen them. But One of my favorite is it was a mid-length par four where you have room to hit driver off the tee, but it's typically going to lead you to something where you don't have as good a visual for the second shot. You may not have as good an angle, whereas there are two or three other options off the tee to play a little less aggressively, a little less aggressively than that, you know, and maybe even really conservatively, to where you got four different ways you can hit a tee shot, and you're standing on the tee, and you've got four players that hit the ball all about the same length, and all four of them might choose a different way to play the hole. And I like doing that on mid-length par fours with movement in the fairway, width in the fairway, and whether it's bunkers or rough or trees, I try not to use water too often, but do it in such a way that when you stand on the tee, it's, you know, if you're, you know, you've never played there before and your buddy says, you know, you go up to him and say, well, what'd I do here? And, you know, immediately says, well, just hit it down the left side. Well, that to me, I try to avoid that in design. I want it to be where, you really kind of stand on the tee and your buddy says, well, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this. And that's what to me is interesting. And you don't want to do that on, you know, necessarily every hole, because some of your holes, are going to fit the flow of the golf course when they are a little bit more simple in strategy. But that's one thing I really enjoy. And we're working on a project at Rumson Country Club right now where Jack Skirkanich, one of the guys that works with me, we've worked on this hole at the project we're doing up there. It's going to be a new hole, completely new hole. And we've got it to where off the tee you can hit like a 5-wood and stay short of some bunkers down the right-hand side. You get a good look at the green, but your angle's not quite as good. But you're only going to be hitting a 140-yard shot in from there. So it's, you know, it's not overly long. But if you hit 3-wood, you're taking the bunker. The bunker comes more into play. You've got a shorter shot, but you got to play a little bit further left, and the visuals aren't as good. If you hit driver and you're an average length player, you've got to hit it further left, which leaves you a shorter shot, but the visual gets even worse. Mm-hmm. And then if you're a long player and you want to try to hit driver and fit it up into a neck, the risk of hitting the driver leaves you with not that great of a reward, but it's still enticing to try to hit driver if you're a longer player. And so, you know, that's something that's kind of a favorite of mine. And I think, you know, every golf course that I've done over the last 10 years or so, I would say that you're going to find some elements like that. So yeah. I don't think it's a signature because it's done before, but it's something I really tend towards.
Mm-hmm. Are there any of the old great architects that you look to their work and say, oh, yeah, I'm going to use that a lot?
Tillinghast, you know, just in the way that he set features on the ground that would challenge you visually, and then physically he challenged you to not only play proper angles, but he also challenged you to play proper distances. There's a lot, you know, really good old Tillinghast golf courses, required you to think off the tee. On how far you were going to hit it on a certain line. And, there's so many golf courses today that you see on the PGA Tour where, you know, a guy can stand up, a Brooks Koepka or, Dustin Johnson, and they can just hit it as far as they want down the fairway. And Tillinghast course is really good at making all players have to think, you know, not only about positioning left, right, or middle, but also how far am I going to hit it. And then, McKenzie and Maxwell, especially in the work they did together, and they didn't do much work together, but the Crystal Downs that they did in Oklahoma City really put you in positions where to get to a hole location, to even have a chance to get to a hole location, you've got to be at the proper distance, at the proper angle. And so those are those two guys, McKenzie, Maxwell, and working together especially, but then Tillinghast, I refer back to those a lot.
One of the things that I talk about a lot when I'm trying to explain what I do with this podcast is say that if you have a strong mental slash emotional game, and if you understand course management or strategy, that you can lower your scores quicker than if you're just going out and hitting a bucket of balls four times a week. Is there an advantage for the average golfer to think like an architect when he's standing at the tee?
Absolutely. And it's not only on the tee, but it's in playing second shots. You know, there's...
Well, then I guess the question would be from tee to green.
Exactly. And so, you know, off the tee, you know, you really, the average player probably can benefit as much or more from than the better player, because a lot of better players today, you know, there's so, you know, at the college level and at the mid-am level, you know, obviously at the professional level, but they're so good at playing second shots from out of position, that for the average player, focusing more on being in position to play the hole in a way that is going to help your overall score is vital. You know, a 15 handicap needs to realize that means that on average they're going to bogey 15 holes in par three. You know, it's your typical par 72. That's where the course rating they're playing from is around 72. That's what they're going to average, and so they have to think that way. And too many of them will be, you know, they'll hit driver on a hole they don't really need to, and bring more trouble into play. And the one thing that I see a lot of is they'll be 220 yards from a green that's well protected on both the left and right sides, and there's plenty of fairway short of the green, but they'll go ahead and hit their 3-wood or, you know, or 5-wood, whatever they can hit 220 yards, and try to hit it on the green when their chances of hitting that green are probably 10%. And you know, this might be one of the longer par fours when, and they're bringing 6 and 7 into play when, if they were to play short, they're generally going to have 4 or 5 in play.
Fabulous! Oh my God, that is so helpful, so good. Thank you so much, and it's great to talk to you again. I really appreciate you coming back on the show, and congratulations on Oklahoma City Country Club and for the future. Thanks so much for coming back on.
Thanks, Fred.
All right, it's time to announce this week's winner of our Golf Smarter Championship Toolkit, which includes exclusive Golf Smarter cap that you can see our top golf winners wearing, a sleeve of Dixon Earth balls with the Golf Smarter logo, a set of Shoe Tips thought reminders, a Windage wind powder to help you play the wind, the Extraordinary Golf DVD by Fred Shoemaker, 2 books on peak performance by Scott Ford, and the book Selling on the Green. That is quite the package we've put together for you, and I want to congratulate Sawat Fruksawan of Pleasant Hill, California. Sawat, we only live about an hour apart from one another, so how about we meet somewhere in the middle this year and get 18 holes in? Of course, only if you agree to wear that Golf Smarter cap I was talking about. Congratulations, Sawat. So after 5 months of a different prize each week, we're going down to our last 2 prizes in our giveaway. And because these last 2 are so incredible, I'm going to skip next week's giveaway to make sure that you don't miss your chance to register to win either of these prizes. On December 18th, episode 668, the winner will receive a 1-year subscription to the Decade Golf app from Scott Fawcett. For all the details of what the Decade app can do to improve your game overnight, make sure to listen to last week's episode with Scott. Then our final prize is really exciting because I have some additional news to share about that prize. Next week, our guest is going to be Cody Hale of Seymour Putters. Cody is the director of tour operations and their Seymour Putter Institute. Cody is going to talk to us from his putting studio about working with tour pros of all levels to getting them fitted to the perfect Seymour putter. He'll also share with us the various putters in their lineup and what putter is best for what kind of player. Then, once you've completely gotten fired up about those putters, you'll have 1 more week until we announce on Christmas Day who's going to work with Cody to get your very own Seymour putter. Well, let me give you a quick testimonial. I've been using a Seymour putter since this summer, and there is no doubt in my mind that along with the new puppy, that putter will be around for quite a while. So make sure your name is on the list to win one of these great prizes. And if you've already registered once, you're still eligible for every one of these last drawings, whether you've won or not. Deadline to enter is Sunday, midnight, Pacific time, or 3 a.m. Eastern, Monday morning, with the final sign-up ending on December 23rd, 2018. Sign up now at golfsmarter.com/giveaway. And don't forget to go to tgw.com/golfsmarter for 20% off apparel with the coupon code GOLFSMARTER at checkout. The exclusive Golf Smarter 20% off apparel sale ends on February 5th, 2019 at 11:59 p.m. Central Time. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, and I really do appreciate them, they have been coming in more frequently lately from all over the world. I can't tell you how excited I am that it's golf season again in Australia, because all of a sudden 10% of our audience is down under, and I really would love to come down and play with you guys, but I can't. So anyway, not now. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Golf Smarter, or click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.